Chestnut Hill FM News.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. The question is, if Joe Biden was not running his own auto pen, then who exactly was running the United States of America? Now, I know that some of you are going to respond to that by saying, well, Lars, it was only the auto pen. It was only about pardons and commutations. Maybe it involved executive orders, might have involved a piece of legislation or two, but that doesn't mean that Joe was not fully in charge of the United States of America. Actually, I think the most recent evidence, and by the way, the source of that evidence, the Democrats' Holy Bible, the New York Times, which has reported now that Joe Biden did not sign off on many of those pardons and commutations that went to criminals. Now, he did put his own signature on the pardon or commutation that went to his, you know, son, Joe Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden got a full-on free ride for anything he had done over the last decade or so. That means he'll never be prosecuted for any of the many crimes that it appears he committed, both tax crimes and gun crimes and things like that. For some reason, Joe Biden insisted that it be his signature on that. But on the rest of it, he kind of delegated off the authority. Now, is a president allowed to do that legally? I don't think so. But then again, I don't think we've ever had that idea tested in a court. Let me get into the details of it and tell you why I think it extends well beyond the auto pen, which has been the suspicion of mine and probably for many of you for the last 4 years. Well, what is the significance of that today? Well, it means that if people got pardons, if people got commutations, if pieces of legislation got signed by an auto pen because a staffer decided to sign it, is it still valid? Nobody has a legal answer to that just yet. We can hope to get one sometime in the next couple of years. Glad to get your phone calls on a Monday. Always glad to take those calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to answer our X poll, you'll find the daily poll question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find the same question, although only vote once. We are, in fact, a conservative show. We only believe in voting one vote to a person. You can find that at LarsLarson.com. But let me get back to what the New York Times has finally said out loud. Mr. Biden did not individually approve each name for the categorical pardons that applied to large numbers of people. That has been confirmed by Joe Biden. It has been confirmed by aides to Joe Biden. Rather, after extensive discussion of different possible criteria, Biden signed off on the standards that he wanted applied and which convicts would qualify and which would not. In other words, anybody who fits in this category, they get a commutation or a pardon from the president. Is that the way that the founders of this country, when they wrote the Constitution and gave the president the power of pardon and commutation, is that the way they intended it to run? I don't think it is. But they say, quote, and I'll quote again the New York Times, even after Mr. Biden made that decision, one former aide told us, the Bureau of Prisons kept providing additional information about specific inmates, resulting in changes to the list. Rather than ask Mr. Biden to keep on signing revised versions, his staff waited and then ran the final version through the auto pen, which they saw as a routine procedure. Let me suggest to you why I think they saw it as a routine procedure. I think that most of the people who worked on a day-to-day basis with Joe Biden understood he was not calling the shots for the United States of America. You know what Joe was in charge of? Trying to keep his errant son out of trouble you know, cocaine in the White House, hookers and cocaine in Las Vegas, buying guns illegally, disposing of them illegally, and having to run the Secret Service out to take care of them. That happened before Joe even became president. But was he in charge of ice cream every afternoon? He certainly was. Was he actually making the critical decisions that are important about running the United States of America from the executive branch? He was not in charge. And that seems clearer than ever today. His mental decline is still being covered up. I hope you took note that last week, his own personal doctor went before Congress, called there to testify about Joe Biden's mental state, and he pleaded the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which means he was saying, if I tell you the truth, if I testify, I will implicate myself in criminal activity. Now imagine what that says about the status of a president that his own doctor can't talk about his mental state or he might be committing a crime. Mr. Biden did not individually approve each name. Now, was the power of commutation intended to be given to a president? Yes. Was it intended to be given to a president who then handed off to somebody else and say, you decide who gets the commutation, you decide who gets the pardon? I don't believe that it was. In fact, one of Joe Biden's former aides, Neera Tanden, had admitted under oath to the House Oversight Committee. They did a closed-door testimony from Neera Tanden. She was one of the people who, for a period of time, October of 21 to May of 23, about a year and a half, she was in control of the auto pen, or at least she was one of those who was authorized to use it. Well, the Washington Examiner reports that Neera Tanden testified she was authorized to direct the auto pen. She denied any manipulation or abuse, but what would you expect her to do? Did you think she was going to tell the Congress? You bet. Joe wasn't running things. Joe was demented. Joe couldn't operate but between the hours of about 10 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which kind of brings back almost exactly a year ago, just over a year ago, June of last year, is when Joe Biden had that catastrophic debate with Donald Trump. Now, what happened in it? The Democrats and Joe Biden signed off on a debate that began at 9 o'clock at night. By all accounts, Joe Biden was completely out to lunch by anything after about 6 o'clock at night. Now, why they would authorize that? Who knows? Lots of conspiracy theories about whether or not Joe was actually in charge of his own campaign. Well, the Constitution does give the president the power of commutation and pardon. Can you delegate that out? That's one important question we ought to get answered. Who was actually running the White House? A second question. And it goes to the broader question, who was running the White House and what decisions did they make? And let me give you one example I've given you before this year. Just over a year ago, House Speaker Mike Johnson says he sat down with President Biden at that time, just over a year ago, and asked him, why did you ban new natural gas export facilities? Those would have meant billions of dollars in investment, tens of thousands of jobs, lots of economic opportunity and tax revenue and everything else. Biden told Johnson he didn't know anything about a ban, except that Biden had signed the ban, we're told, just 2 months before Johnson asked the question. So did Joe Biden not know about the ban he had put on new natural gas export facilities, a multi-billion dollar decision for the United States? Did Joe Biden actually sign that ban, or did his staff do it and then never bother to tell him about it? It's a Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next. If you've been...
Some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? thanks.
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, 4 months ago, President Trump ordered more logging in America's national forests, but the message seems not to have penetrated down to the Bureau of Land Management here in the Pacific Northwest. Last week, I talked to Dennis Teitzel, Northwest Oregon BLM manager for the last 3 years. He admits that the BLM is authorized to cut up to 350 million board feet of trees worth more than $100 million, but the agency is only cutting about two-thirds of that number for reasons that Teitzel could not explain. I asked how much more could be cut from BLM forests at what's called sustained yield, where you never run out of trees, they grow faster than you're cutting them. Teitzel told me he didn't have any idea, as he is not a forester, but he is only the BLM manager. If you do the math, those 100 million board feet that BLM did not cut, but they were allowed to cut them in Northwest Oregon, would create between 800 and 1,100 jobs in the small towns of the Northwest. It also produces a lot of tax money for the federal treasury. And, of course, you can build houses with the lumber that comes out of it. America currently imports, I checked the number this morning, 28% of its lumber from other countries, which would be kind of like Saudi Arabia importing oil. If you want to know how President Trump could pay America's bills without higher taxes, take a drive down any highway and look at all the green that's standing there on both sides. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And as always, naysayers go to the head of the line. Our question of the day, which is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Now, what about that story that tells of a new Tina Kotek law against splashing in Oregon rivers? I kid you not. Well, Laura wrote to me, a nice lady, and she said, Lars, with the hotter weather in the forecast, be sure to get your kicking in a river done before the governor's new proposed law against splashing goes into effect. I must have read it four times now. Really, it will have a fine of up to $500 unless you buy a splashing permit first, only $49.99 a year. If you splash accidentally, you must report it. There will even be splash river patrol officers. Fees are going up on all river water recreation. Even inner tubes roped together will need to get a permit. What happened to summertime fun? Well, I wrote back to Laura, and I told her I was using her note. Laura, it is an Oregon satire site. I mentioned it last week. It is a parody news story. There is no new law against splashing from Tina Kotek. Although, I'd point out that the fact that so many people got taken in by this satire or parody tells you a lot. It tells you that folks think the Democrats might actually do such a thing because they do a lot of crazy stuff that turns out to be real. This one is not. I talked about it last week. I'll keep on doing so until folks actually find out the truth. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really
presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, I want to give today's Daily Grill to Democrat Representative David Gomberg. He is a representative in the Oregon legislature. He belongs to the supermajority party of the Democrats. And as the Fish Wrapper reported, a powerful lawmaker from the Oregon coast will see the roads in his own subdivision resurfaced using federal wildfire recovery money after he wielded his position and access as a lawmaker to press state housing leaders to clear hurdles raised by lower level employees who had repeatedly questioned whether the project qualified for funding. David Gomberg, representative and Democrat, lives just outside of Lincoln City. He regularly contacted state housing leaders from his legislative email account about a $760,000 grant and spoke to them directly in his capacity as a lawmaker about the project. He said, while my interest in progress on all of these projects, I am, of course, most familiar with the one in my own district. He didn't say it was his own drive. In fact, He was very familiar with it, as the fish wrapper says. Gomberg's house is on the main road to be fixed by the project, and his wife Susan applied for the money in her capacity as a board member for their homeowners association, which represents about four dozen properties. The rural subdivision where they live was partially burned during the 2020 Labor Day fires that engulfed communities in western Oregon and the Cascades. The roads in the subdivision were used by heavy equipment during the cleanup and the rebuild process, they argued, making the project eligible for recovery money. I would say that Representative Gomberg has a dog in the fight. He was trying to get public money to pay for a road that benefited him and his family and his neighborhood in particular. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me. I'll tell you what, it looks fantastic. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Colleen writes in, Lars, driving around Portland this morning, I'm struck by how many Democrats and how they have destroyed this once wonderful city in every way imaginable. From homeless campers and zombie RVs on every street, except where wealthy Democrats and government employees live, to snarled traffic. Clotting up traffic makes drivers angry and aggressive, just like Chicago. Why anybody would turn Portland into Chicago intentionally is beyond me. I went to the store at 8 a.m., very little traffic, but it's still all jammed up. Peabot fixes the lights so that either 3 to 5 cars get through on a green, or a red is red for 3 to 5 minutes. And then there's a government contractor vehicle blocking two lanes. Not sure what's going on there. He was just sitting in the vehicle when I passed him by going to the store until the time I passed him coming back. Milking the clock and snarling traffic is my guess. Anyway, about 8 a.m. on a Saturday in Portland takes 15 to 20 minutes to drive 15 blocks. One driver couldn't take it anymore, floored it up to 25 miles an hour, woo, and turned left on a solid red light. There was a pedestrian walking across the street. If there was an accident, if the car hit the pedestrian, it would be the driver's fault, certainly. But it would also be the fault of Peabot and the city of Portland. They are creating aggressive, angry drivers intentionally. I could go on because Democrats have completely destroyed the city, but I will leave it at Portland traffic. What do you think? Are Democrats destroying Portland intentionally or incompetently? Are they evil or are they just stupid? Well, Colleen, I think it's just a little bit of both. By the way, I want to update you on this. The Washington State Ferry mess that was created by Jay Inslee, who insisted not on diesel, clean diesel, to run those ferries, but hybrid electric systems. Their newest ferry, $133 million. Washington is planning to spend $4 billion to convert the entire fleet. I don't really have a problem with hybrid cars, but a ferry? How much benefit does it get to regenerate on the water? A car's in contact with the road, but a ferry only has a propeller to regenerate that power. Another thing is the high cost of power in city of Seattle. Average cost, almost 13 cents per kilowatt hour. That is a suggestion for a waste of money in Washington State. And Jack, I have to agree with you 100%. Coming up, Tina Kotek is likely to call a special session of the legislature to get the work done they didn't get done during the regular session that only ended a couple of weeks ago. One gentleman has a great to-do list for what the governor needs to do first.
The Lars Larson Show. Constantine Kissin on Hamas.
For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. There are positives as well. I mean, say what you want about Hamas supporters. At least they know what a woman is.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've commented before that it really says a lot about where Oregon stands right now, that it has all statewide offices filled by Democrats. It has super majorities of Democrats in the House and the Senate. Virtually every large city's city council, county commission is filled with Democrats or even folks who are far to the left of Democrats, and very few Republicans or conservatives at all. But now the Oregon legislature is in a spot. They met for 6 months. They didn't get all the work done. And now it seems almost certain that Governor Tina Kotek will call them back for a special session. And Mark Hester, who'd worked for 20 years at the Oregonian, including business, editorial, and editorial writer, he now writes at Oregon Roundup, and he has a couple of suggestions for what Tina Kotek needs to do before she calls that special session. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. Good to talk to you.
I can barely hear you. Now, I'm not sure if it's your phone or what, but I want my audience to hear what you have to say.
Let me try again. Is that better?
Yeah, just a bit. But let's get your suggestions on what you think Tina Kotek needs to do, and is she even capable of doing what she needs to do to be able to get a special session of the legislature that usually involves a 1 or 2 day meeting and get them to pass whatever it is that it's going to take to be able to get state government funded the way the Democrats wanted funded, because they didn't have the guts to pass the bill. They had the votes, but they didn't have the guts, thank God, to pass a $15 billion tax increase.
Okay. Well, I will start with the first item in my column, which is a metaphor, and I'll go more directly to the point than the metaphor on the air. She needs to change her leadership style. Tina Kotek, throughout her career, has been known as someone who relied heavily on power and intimidation to get what she wanted. That clearly is not working now, and she doubled down on that at the end of the session. So if doubling down didn't work, I don't think tripling down or quadrupling down is going to work. So she needs to determine what carrots she's willing to give up to try to come to a place that both parties can live with. And that's going to be difficult because the legislature is not great at compromise, and it's not the style of leadership she's used to.
Except that when you say they're not ready to compromise, I guess I found it notable that when the Democrats have supermajorities in both houses, they had sufficient votes to be able to pass that massive, biggest tax increase in state history, and they didn't do it. I think even they knew there was something wrong with it. So do they have to refigure what it is, the assumptions they're making about government, to say maybe we don't need all that money? When even Democrats effectively vote against a new tax, doesn't that suggest there must be something really screwed up about the new level of taxation?
Well, that was my number two point, is she needs to analyze all the taxes and prioritize them. And, yes, it's they have gotten so high that even some Democrats aren't willing to push them higher, not even with her holding metaphorical stick to try to beat them into submission. So, she's got to look at those taxes. And as I say in the column, she knows it's too high because she's pushing Multnomah County to cut their preschool tax, which, though I don't agree with that tax and particularly the way it's structured, I don't blame Vega Peterson for resisting, because that's a higher hypocrisy to say cut your taxes so I can raise my taxes.
I was going to say, I don't think she thinks taxes are too high. She just thinks I need to get my taxes through for the government I run, and I want everybody else to stay out of my way, which sounds like one of the most arrogant approaches to government I've ever seen, saying my government taxes come before yours. Yours are going to create a problem for me, so therefore you guys knock it off until I get my taxes passed.
Yeah, that's another way of saying it, but I don't disagree with anything you just said.
Well, now, what about this? The Republicans said we gave the legislature a plan where ODOT's basic services could be preserved and there would be no new taxes at all. They'd get by on the money they have right now, which is around $3 billion a year or $6 billion per biennium. How about considering that? Say, come back and vote on it. As I understand, the Republicans presented that option, said there's the plan. You don't have to raise taxes at all, and they couldn't even get it voted.
That gets back to point number three in my column, which is have an honest discussion with union leaders, because one has to assume the reason they would not accept that as a compromise is because the unions were saying, don't you dare accept that.
Are the unions now running the state of Oregon? I mean, as though that's not an obvious, obviously answered question, right?
Do you need the word now in there?
Yeah, no, I don't need the word. And Mark, here's the crazy thing. We're constantly told, I worked in public service for 30 years. Well, hold on. If you're serving the public, but your needs come ahead of the public's needs, then I don't think you're a public servant. And I know some public employees who I know are not going to like me saying that. But if you said the most important thing here is not serving the public, it's making sure that all these public employees get served first, then you ain't a public servant.
Yes, I agree. And that sort of leads, this goes a little beyond the column, but one of the most puzzling things to me about the way the governor has handled this, and I just briefly touch on it in the column, is what does she think her ultimate payoff is? I mean, I don't know what her real plans are. We've all heard the rumors. But if she thinks cutting public services, including really necessary stuff like plowing major roads, to preserve as many jobs as possible or to make a point or whatever, if she's trying to make the public's pain greater than the public employee's pain, I don't think that's a political move that makes sense.
No, it doesn't. I think she's at the end of her political career. Mark, thanks very much. And sorry about the bad phone line. I don't know what happened with that, but I'll tell you what. We'll make sure it's a better one next time. That's Mark Hester. He writes at Oregon Roundup. And just a couple of thoughts for you. I saw over the weekend one ODOT manager who's saying, well, if this is the amount of money we're going to have, only $3 billion for a year, or about $250 million every single month, you're talking about 10 million bucks a day, pretty close. And they say, but if you're only going to give us that much, then the snow is not going to get plowed through the mountain passes. Well, with 5,000 employees, I don't think ODOT has any excuse for what they're doing. And yet that's clearly what they intend to communicate. They are cutting the smaller operations around the state. They are cutting down to a bare fraction. I'm not hearing anybody in Salem say, well, we cut a whole bunch of bureaucrats. We took a whole bunch of paper pushers and we said, you don't have a job anymore. We have to preserve the money to make sure that the basic services to the public are delivered. You're not hearing that. And Governor Kotek is the chief of the executive branch of government in Oregon, just like President Trump is the head of the executive branch for the United States of America. If Tina Kotek is not willing to actually act like a chief executive and tell her departments, you will supply basic services, she's letting ODOT get away with simply saying, if the public is not going to give us a whole bunch more money, $1.5 billion a year for 10 years, then we are going to punish the public until they give us what we want. If that is the message from ODOT, then to hell with them. And as far as I'm concerned, if the Republicans say Democrats aren't willing to do a no tax increase plan, then we just won't show up in Salem and they won't get voted anything through. ODOT will be stuck. And at that point, the public will see the true colors of the Tina Kotek administration. Yes, it's going to hurt. But yes, I think it'll actually bring some people around and say we can't vote Democrats to be single party rule in Oregon anymore. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Ronald Reagan knew better. Do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. I hope you all have a wonderful summer and stay cool as much as you can. At least we're not in California, where they're likely to face rolling blackouts. Although the rolling blackouts and brownouts, they're probably a real possibility for this. region. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our X poll today, should the Portland Trailblazers get their arena renovated at taxpayer expense? Well, now that the Trailblazers, who are up for sale, it'll be interesting to see who buys them and whether or not they keep them in the Portland Metro. But the Moda Center, the one that was built at the expense of Paul Allen, he paid for it privately, and then the Blazers decided to sell the whole thing to the city of Portland for a dollar. Yeah, and you say, wow, what a good deal. Except the thing is plus 30 years old, which means it needs to be renovated. That's going to cost a lot of money. And now there is a suggestion from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. They're saying, why don't we do it on the jock tax? In other words, the income taxes paid for by the Trailblazers players who make multi-million dollar salaries, they've been paying income taxes for years. And the Oregonian actually thinks it would be a great idea to go out and use the jock tax. In other words, divert all the money that is coming from NBA player salary taxes and use it to renovate the Moda, which is now owned by the city of Portland. It was a stupid decision, and I said so at the time. When the city of Portland bought it for a dollar, the first thing they gave up was a couple of million bucks a year in property taxes, because when it was owned by a private company, they had to pay property taxes. Now that it's owned by the city of Portland, they do not have to pay property taxes, and they own the need for any kind of renovation. Let's go to Alan. Hey, Alan, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind? Hey, Alan. Nah, Alan's not there. I don't know what's going on with Alan, but we'll see if we can check his line and find out why his cell phone is failing. I do want to tell you about one other thing. The Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, that's Oregon Live, although occasionally the Seattle Times acts like a fish wrapper. They know how to pick some real winners as their sympathy case of the day for public welfare. And they did that this last weekend. So what happened? They characterized, or they portrayed, a man by the name of John Herrick. He is 47 years old. He had the misfortune to suffer a heart attack last August, almost a year ago. And you say, that's horrible. Did he recover? He did recover. He went back to work in September, and then for whatever reason, he got laid off from his job. So he went on unemployment. Now, what's he been living on ever since? Well, his unemployment went for about 5 months. He is now living in a hotel room paid for by the VA. Now, that's terrible, but you say, I hope that guy gets back to work. When he was on unemployment, I know the rules of the unemployment system, although I've never taken it myself. Unemployment says that you must be actively seeking work, otherwise you don't qualify for unemployment. So he's a former IT professional. I don't know specifically what Mr. Herrick did for a living. I don't know what part of IT he worked in, but he still doesn't have a job almost a year later. So he's been living on unemployment and then welfare for the last, 11 months or so. So the questions I had when I saw that story, he was on unemployment. It requires you to look for work. Did he find a job? A full-time minimum wage job in Oregon is $33,000 a year. That's not a lot to live on, even for a single person. But the story also showed Mr. Herrick's two adult sons, who are also living in the hotel room paid for by the VA. So I did the math. If Herrick and his two sons worked full-time minimum wage jobs, it would give them at least a household income of $99,000. Would that pay the bills for three adult men? And the answer is it would. Now, let's say they could only find half-time minimum wage jobs. They would still have a household income since they're all living in the same hotel room. I assume they might want a room together when they get back to the private sector. That would bring in $45,000 every year. And then there's the question of why Oregon is using Medicaid money for the housing. The story was all about Mr. Herrick's pursuit of some Medicaid money, which has been diverted to housing. How do you figure that Medicaid money, which is supposed to be for health insurance for the poor, well, they made some exceptions and said, in an emergency, you can use Medicaid money to provide somebody housing. Now, I can imagine a sympathetic case like, say, a 75-year-old man or woman who goes into the hospital, loses his or her apartment while they're in the hospital because they can't pay the rent, and then comes out and needs a little bit of assistance to be able to get back into housing. I could see using some of that Medicaid money, because if you're that old and you've just come out of the hospital, it wouldn't be healthy for you to be living on the streets. But does that apply to three able-bodied adult men, Mr. Herrick and his two adult sons? I don't think it does. Is the state of Oregon short of cash? No. They have $900 million that is allocated for this program, and they can't figure out how to get it out the door. Alan, welcome back to the program.
Lars, I'm the CEO of a construction company, and I want to give you some numbers that are pretty startling to illustrate the massive amount of waste in ODOT. So everything in the private sector is gross revenue per employee of income. And
right.
Specifically what I mean by that is in the sector of highway, for
example. Alan, I'm going to ask you to hold on. I'm going to have to do that because we're up against a break. I want to hear the whole story because ODOT and waste, we ought to figure that one out before we give them one more dime of money. Alan, thanks for the call. We'll talk to you later.
The Lars Larson.
At Viking.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And government simply grows too fast. And if you want a great example, take the state of Washington. I happen to make my home in the state of Washington. 10 years ago, in the 2013-15 budget, it's a two-year budget in this case, not a one-year budget, the state of Washington spent $80 billion. And you say, okay, so it's probably increased a bit because you've had inflation over the last 10 years. You had about 2% a year for five of those years. You had about 22% under Joe Biden. Even if you add the two together, it should add up to maybe 30% increase because of inflation. So how much has the state budget increased? Well, I'm going to let the author of an article in the Center Square talk about it because he researched the whole thing. That's T.J. Martinelli, who joins me now, journalist and staff reporter at the Center Square. T.J., welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
So how much did it increase? If population increased maybe 20%, I looked up the numbers, and inflation went up maybe 30% over those 10 years, largely because of the Biden years, the state budget should have gone up maybe 30%. How much did it actually go up?
It went up $173 billion, which was a 116% increase over that time period.
Now, when you researched this, could you find anything in the operations of government that justified having the increase in the state budget go up at three times the rate that population and inflation would do it?
I mean, that's the big question, is what's exactly been accomplished with all this increased spending? And that's something that I'm going to be looking at as part of this series, because there was, what was crazy is there was five areas in the budget that combined, and just those five, it was $77.2 billion in increased spending over that 10-year period. And, you know, you had like long-term care went up in spending by 239%. Almost all these, the only one that didn't go 100% increase was general apportionment, and that was 98.2, so basically 100%. So we're talking a massive amount of increased spending. And, you know, one of them was public schools, and I think nobody's going to argue by any metric that the academic performance and achievements by students has gone down with that increased spending.
Yeah, so you spend more, you get less in education. And in every other way, is it fair to say that when you see any government in America spend money, that about 80% of the money goes to salaries of government employees?
Yeah, that's what happened in public education, is that they hired a lot of non-teaching staff. So you had a lot of extra and new employees, and then also pay increases. And this was across the board for state employees. One thing to note that is worth keeping in mind on is that this represents state and federal spending. But the issue with that is if the federal government reduces its funding to the state budget, the state either has to reduce services or find another way of funding it. So while it's not state tax dollars directly that constitutes the entire combined spending, if the feds cut funding like they might in some areas, and as we're seeing with, you know, what's going on in Congress, the state then has to deal with that. That's still a budget crisis. And keep in mind, right now, our state is forecasted to run out of money by 2027, and it's forecasted to go into a $400 million fiscal deficit by 2028.
Yeah, and so even though they got the biggest tax increase that Washington State has ever seen in its history out of the last legislature earlier this year, they're still going to be running hundreds of millions of dollars short. What new things did the state start doing that cost more money? Or is this just them saying it costs this much to supply the same services, roughly, that we were supplying 10 years ago?
Yeah, that's the good question. I know for a fact, and I'm working on a story about this already, there's programs that they started up and that they've been funding. So you have an expansion of what government is spending its money on and who it's giving money to, and, you know, the number of government services that are available to certain segments of the population who are now, you know, for example, you had the healthcare authority, their spending increased by 131%. It went from $16.5 billion to $38 billion. So that, and I mean, that's more money than they spend on public schools. So healthcare authority, the healthcare spending in our state is a huge portion of the budget.
And yet they tell you we don't have nearly enough, right? I mean, is anybody over at the Department of Health saying, man, you know what, we're flush these days, don't give us any more?
The only time I've ever heard a state official say we don't need more money was someone from the Washington State Department of Transportation. That's about the only time I've ever heard anyone say that, at least publicly. But, I mean, the way, and what's crazy is this is at a time of record revenue levels. They are getting more money than they've ever gotten before, and the spending has, you know, the revenue is not keeping up with spending, even though they're passing all these new taxes. And so it just, that is the question that we're going to be asking in part of this series is, so we spent all this money and increased spending, what was accomplished, what was achieved? And I actually reached out to the Senate Ways and Means Chair for comment, and she didn't respond. I also reached out to the governor's office, and they didn't respond.
No, and in fact, I just wonder, TJ, one of my favorite questions to ask people who come on the show who want to pimp their campaign. I mean, they're running for something, city council, county commission, state legislature, whatever it happens, U.S. Congress. And I say, what's something that your government, the government you're running for, does that it doesn't need to be doing? And they all act like they act like a deer caught in the headlights. They're like, what do you mean? Everything we do is essential. And I think, well, if you went back a bit, you could find lots of things government didn't do then that it does do now. Is all of that essential? Or would it be better done in the private sector? And I think there are plenty of things that would match that.
Right. And the issue also is that with the spending, it's now the status quo. So trying to reduce the spending, which they may have to do if they are going to run a fiscal deficit, there's going to be a sense of, for lack of a better word, entitlement or expectation that these services, these programs, and this money will continue to be there. And when someone tries to propose taking it away, that could cause a lot of problems. So I think that that's also the danger is that the lawmakers, because back during the recession, they had to cut spending. They just realized we cannot raise taxes and tax ourselves out of this recession. So they cut billions of dollars in out of the operating budget. They could face this thing and there's no recession. I mean, that's the just shows how much worse it could get. If there's an economic recession, they could be looking at a massive, I mean, potentially $20 billion, $25 billion shortfall. You know, where are they going to cut the spending?
I'll tell you what, I would go in and start. Well, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court just announced within the last hour or two that it's given Donald Trump the freedom to go ahead and start firing people at the Department of Ed. If the entire Department of Education disappeared tomorrow, I don't think public education at the local level would be affected much at all. But a lot of political and sexual indoctrination of kids in public schools would probably stop. That is TJ Martinelli. TJ, thanks very much. Journalist and staff reporter at the Center Square. Interesting to ask yourself. That's an increase of about 11% a year in spending over the last 10 years. Has your paycheck increased 11% a year any year? And has your paycheck increased 11% a year for the last 10 years? If not, you can't afford. The cost of summertime.
Truth be told, Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. One of my biggest concerns, and you hear about it all the time on this show, is the amount of money government spends and the kind of service that citizens actually get. So when Alan called the show, I don't know Alan personally, but when he called the show and said, look, I'm going to tell you about some waste, fraud, and abuse, I'd be glad to hear all about it, Alan. We'd like to drive it out of government altogether. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lars. You know, when you sit in a room, in a boardroom with financial people analyzing, in this case, a heavy civil or highway construction company, it's never what can we spend. It's how much per year in annual revenue does an employee have to generate? This is how the private sector works.
Yep.
Including high material costs, union labor, prevailing wages, et cetera. An average employee in this space of ODOT should generate about $200,000 a year on average in revenue. You times that by 5,000 employees, just basic math, that would generate about $1 billion a year company, which breaks down to about $83 million a month, and on a high revenue, about $3.8 million a day would be generated from 5,000 people in the private sector. And that's at a 12%, nearly $400,000 a day gross profit.
Okay.
So basically, when you look at the state of Oregon, they're 2 to 3 times, and they're saying, you know, at $10 million a day spend, that it's not enough money. So it's just one more example of the gross negligence and abuse and waste that's happening in government and why it should be outsourced to the private sector. They do better, they do it faster, they do it for less, and they do higher quality work. ODOT should literally be a group of engineers that oversee workmanship, and everything else should go to the private sector.
Well, Alan, I've given this example before, so I'll probably bore somebody with it, but about 20, 25 years ago, the country of New Zealand, right, which is a country, they ran into some severe financial problems, and they are comparable to a state like Oregon because they have about the same population. It's a very close, but within 10%, they have about the same number of lane miles of road. You know, if you have a 2-lane road, it has fewer lane miles than a 4-lane road, and all that. The same number of lane miles. Within 10%, same amount of population, same kind of culture. So they're a car driving culture, like Oregon. They don't do mostly mass transit. They're not a third world country, so they're not walking around or riding on bicycles much. And you say, okay, what did they have? Their Department of Transportation was 6,000 people, and then they ran into a financial brick wall, and they said, what are we going to do? And it's been my favorite example. They literally did the right thing. They cut it from 6,000 to 600, a lot like what you just described. And you say, well, when they saved all that money by surplusing 5,400 jobs, all those people, if they're qualified for other jobs, probably went out and found other jobs in New Zealand. So what'd they do? They went out, and when they needed to build a bridge, they went out for bid and said, we have a design build competition. You tell us what your bid is to come in and design this bridge and put it in place. And they'd pick the winner. I mean, they'd pick the, you know, successful bidder. If it was a road, they did the same thing. They took all the money they didn't spend on 5,400 employees, and probably at wages that were very similar to what are the wages that are paid here, because they're a similar country to ours. And they had a tremendous improvement in service by cutting that department down by ninefold. And it was a great way to solve the problem. And I've suggested it is the model for ODOT. Take the 5,000 employees, at least cut it down to 1,000, and take the savings, the money you save by not having 4,000 extra people, and you sub it out to people in the private sector. And I've, you know, the funny thing is there are people I know who are conservatives who don't trust government any more than I trust government. And yet they'll say, well, private sector, they could screw up. Yes, they could. And when a company screws up, you hold them responsible. Alan, if I hired your construction company to do a job and you didn't finish it or you didn't do it to the quality level you had promised in writing, I'd expect you to come in back and fix it at your expense, right?
Yeah, I mean, and Lars, I just want to say what basically you're saying is the state of Oregon, like New Zealand, would be essentially acting as the general contractor for the state's money. And, yeah. And I'll push back on the 1,000 because the largest construction companies in Oregon and in the West Coast that are generating $3 to $6 billion a year in revenue, you'd be hard pressed to find 200 project managers to run these projects, let alone 1,000. So yeah. I think you're closer to 500.
Okay.
I absolutely concur.
I'll take 500. And then, you know, the state of Oregon has had a bunch of crash and burns. There was at least one very expensive overpass that I think was, you know, about $70 or $80 million. And then they found out they'd build it on bad soil. Well, if you've got 5,000 people, what are those 5,000 people doing since the state does contract out a lot of the actual, you know, asphalt and concrete and rebar part of the job? They hire private companies to do that. Well, then why do you need 5,000 people to manage that?
Yeah, you don't. There's nowhere in the private sector where that would sustain. Just like every other, almost nearly every other aspect of the government in Oregon would absolutely miserably fail in the private sector.
And yet, when it comes to cuts, and they say we have to, and they've cut about 10% of their workforce, about 600, although I guess 300 of those were empty positions. So I don't know if you can actually count that. You saved the money, but if there was a vacant position that didn't have a person in it, then, you know, no work was being performed anyway. But if you have that kind of cut and you say, well, who are you cutting? They're already warning people you won't be able to drive over the mountain passes because we won't have enough people to plow snow. You've got, you know, 46 or 4,400 people left and you can't find a snowplow driver. Who did you fire and who did you keep on salary?
Well, thanks. I was trying to have a relaxing Monday and you just got my blood pressure up. So,
well, sorry about that, but I appreciate the call. Let's go to Jacob. Hey, Jacob, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I wondered if you heard any of the internet scuttlebutt about an executive order coming in August, I guess, stating that federal elections will be only held with voter ID down to tiny precincts and the ballots will not be moved. They'll be all paper.
Well, I know that Donald Trump has said he wants to go back to in-person voting. He wants to have everybody confirmed as a citizen. Does he control that? He does not. Not entirely. What is controlled is the Constitution specifies the date of the presidential election and some of how federal elections are run. But most elections are run at the local level. And what Trump has said, and I think he's already acted on it, is he said to the states, if you aren't willing to come up to the standards for federal elections, you're not getting the federal elections money. But ultimately, Jacob, those decisions about how states run elections, they have to be made by the states. The federal government cannot impose them from above. So I don't think an executive order is going to entirely solve it, but at least they're addressing the problem for now. Jacob, thanks for the call. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
The Lars Larson Show. New new plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. So now that the One Big Beautiful Bill has passed and has been signed into law, that happened on the 4th of July, Donald Trump's tax cuts have been extended. So what is the outlook for America's economy at this point, and economic growth more importantly? Phil Kirpin joins me now, president of American Commitment. Phil, welcome back. Congratulations on the BBB. I think all of us wanted it to pass. It could have been written a little bit differently in my view, but we take what we can get and then we improve on it from there. So where does America go now with its economic growth once this is in place?
Well, I think we've lifted a huge cloud from the U.S. economy. There's no longer the threat of a massive tax hike coming at the end of this year. And we've immediately improved the incentives for business investment because we brought back 100% expensing, which is already largely phased out. We were down to 40%, which meant a lot of businesses were sitting on cash or sitting on capital waiting to see what would happen with these provisions. So I'm very bullish on what this means. I think we're going to see a lot more investment, which means we're going to see a lot more equipment. We're going to see a lot more capital, which is going to raise productivity. It's going to raise incomes. And that's just a huge, huge positive, especially combined with the energy provisions in this bill and the other things that are happening with deregulation in this administration. I think we've really got the ingredients to have a much, much stronger economy going forward. And by the way, I what comes next, and I'll agree with you that it could have been stronger, particularly on spending reforms, I think that what comes next is another reconciliation bill, another exercise like the one we just had with all of the unfinished business on spending. And I think that the House in particular is committed to putting a really good product forward. And then, you know, we'll see if we can get anything through the Senate in terms of spending reforms.
Well, I mean, all of the predicted, well, I guess shouldn't say all. But we were told months ago that when he slapped those tariffs in place, tariffs that I guess are forecast now to generate $300 billion just this year, they've already generated about half that amount so far. And but that by the end of the fiscal year might produce $300 billion. We were told, well, that's going to drive inflation crazy. Has it?
Inflation has been extremely subdued. We're actually below the Fed's 2% target right now when you look at their preferred measure of PCE inflation. And so we've not seen it. It surprises me, to be honest, that we haven't seen more upward pressure on prices. But look, trade is a relatively small percentage of the economy. The tax rates that we're talking about, the tariff rates that we're talking about, are not that large in most cases. Obviously, the ones that were on China for a while were. But, you know, when you take the potential for a huge tax hike off 100% of the economy, slightly higher taxes on less than a third of the economy don't have the kind of bite that they otherwise might. And so I think you have to look at the Trump agenda in its totality. And while the tariffs, all else equal, would tend to push up prices, everything else that the president is doing tends to push down prices because we're expanding production, we're deregulating, we're cutting taxes. And so I think the net result has been a very low inflation environment. And frankly, the only reason we haven't seen the Fed cut is they're politically motivated. Because,
well, and in fact, I wanted to ask you about that.
I suggest they should have.
I think we've all heard rumblings from last week to this week that Jerome Powell may be on his way out, although he'd be leaving early. Do you think we've got the possibility of that? Because I can't stand the guy. I think that the Fed, under his so-called leadership, has not done his job. They're too fast on the, or too slow on the brakes and too slow on the gas every single time. So even if I don't like the Fed, I'd like to see the Fed done away with. But even if you think it's an essential function as a pseudo government, pseudo private agency, nobody can quite describe what it is, two headed giraffe or whatever you want to call it, that as long as we've got to have it, or as long as we're stuck with it, can we get Jerome Powell out and somebody in who can actually make good decisions?
Well, frankly, I would be surprised at this point if Powell leaves early. I think the president has decided not to test the legal question of whether he can fire him, although my understanding of the Constitution certainly suggests he should be able to. But you look at the recent Supreme Court decision where they said the president can fire members of boards and commissions. They just sort of gratuitously threw in there, except for the Federal Reserve, which wasn't even an issue in the case, which kind of telegraphs that they didn't want the president to test them on that. And I think he's looking at it and saying, look, I mean, there's a year to go. I'll wait this guy out and then I'll get someone in there that is more sensible. And so I think he's going to ride it out. I mean, he could leave. He could quit, obviously. But I think he enjoys sort of skunking the president's party, and I would be surprised if he leaves early. And also, I think he wants to see through the obscene renovation of the Fed headquarters that they're spending $2.5 billion. Yeah. $2.5 billion. It's like got rooftop gardens. Everything's, everything's over the top. By the way, I've been in the current Fed headquarters once. I was actually invited there once for a meeting, and it's already like the most over the top luxurious government building. So I don't know what it's going to look like after $2.5 billion renovation, but I think he wants to see that project through. That's his legacy, is the new palace of the Fed.
Well, since you mentioned it, I'm curious. We have an agency that is not fully a government agency, but it's not fully a private entity either, right? Phil?
It is a government agency, but yes, that is the official, it's quasi, and that's what the courts have said.
So why are the taxpayers buying them a new headquarters? You know, if why doesn't the private side of the Fed pay for their new headquarters if they want to have a fancy Taj Mahal? And was there any justification for ditching their old building?
Well, the old building is, I believe, part of the renovation. So it's like an expansion and a renovation. And no, there's no justification. They already have one of the lowest usage. You know, the square footage per employee was already one of the highest in the whole government. So they're expanding. Nobody really knows why, except because they can. And of course, you know, there's not much of a distinction between their money versus our money, because they print the money, and then all the money in your pocket is worth less. And so that's why I think this idea of private versus governmental is sort of nonsense when it comes to the Fed. Everything they do is essentially pursuant to the federal government's power to coin and print money.
Okay, since I've got your ear anyway, I want your take, unvarnished, as to what the heck is going on. You've got a couple of phenomena. One is Scavino and at least one other White House employee doing last-minute stock trades that seemed very timed, but technically it's not insider trading because they're just using the government's information that we have, that we don't have access to make really smart stock trades that would be insider trading if they worked for a private company. Should we end that practice altogether and say, if you want to work in the government, work in the government, but put all your money in a blind trust and don't trade on the information that other Americans don't have access to?
Yeah, I mean, I hate the whole idea of using political information to people who work in the government. This has now just become a huge industry in general. A lot of people who used to be lobbyists have now just become, you know, quote unquote researchers, where they go and figure out what's going on in the government and then sell that information to hedge funds and Wall Street so they can make tons of money on it. I think that this whole idea of trading on political information tells you that the government is way too involved in everything in our economy. If they can move markets to the extent that, you know, having information about government is the ticket to winning trades, that means government needs to be doing a lot less, in my judgment, and moving markets a lot less. And so there's less opportunity for this sort of exploitation. But I also think that, you know, if you work for the government, you should not be trading in your own account. The conflict of interest is too egregious. And so I would support the idea that anyone who works for the government, their money just has to go into basically broad index funds, and they've got to be basically hands off with it. Because otherwise, at least the appearance of impropriety is possible, as well as actual impropriety.
Well, because that was, I mean, Scavino's case was they did the trades. He and one other employee did the trades one day before the tariffs were announced. They knew it was going to cause an effect on Wall Street, and they apparently saved themselves millions of dollars with information the rest of us didn't have. That's Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. Hey, Phil, thanks very much for the call, and glad to have you on. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls at 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. There was a big decision from the U.S. Supreme Court announced just a couple of hours ago. And again, this is usually when the Supreme Court justices are on vacation. It sounds like the first year of Trump's second term is going to keep them busier than they ever imagined. But the Supreme Court has now given the green light to President Trump and the White House to go ahead with layoffs, starting with 1,300 people at the Federal Department of Education. You've heard me advocate for the end of that department for a couple of decades on this show. Department of Ed is worse than useless. It actually uses the people's money, taxpayers' money, to go out and push political agendas in public schools. And the way they push those agendas is they say, we have all this grant money. You can get the grant money. You just have to sign up and then ask for the money and agree to go along with our rules. It is a way to push politics on your kids. So if a school says, we'd like to get that grant, and you say, okay, you have to push diversity, equity, and inclusion. You have to push critical race theory. You have to push all kinds of gender and ideology ideas. And if you're willing to do that, we will give you the cash. And unfortunately, some of the school districts around America, many of them, are willing to act like prostitutes, saying, well, whatever it is you want us to do, we will do it as long as you send us the cash. But now the U.S. Supreme Court and the usual three justices, the three crazy liberals, including Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is now being disparaged by just about everybody on the court because it doesn't seem like she got much knowledge of the law when she went to law school. She keeps writing decisions that are more political diatribes than they are anything about the law. Now, we've always known that six of the justices, to one extent or another, will be relatively conservative. And three of them are relatively liberal. But at least when they write decisions, they say, the reason I'm taking this side, and then they make an argument under the law. It may be a ridiculous argument, but they make the argument under the law. Apparently, Ketanji Brown Jackson, the woman most famous for telling a Senate committee that she could not tell them what a woman is, even though she is one or appears to be one, because she is not a biologist. She would write dissents that even her fellow liberal justices would not join her in. So why is it important that they start cutting at the Department of Ed? Donald Trump has said that he put the person in charge as education secretary so that she could dismantle the agency. Now, so much of that money is used in such political ways that the liberals absolutely lost their minds when the Department of Ed was threatened. So they took it to court and they got a judge in Boston, a federal judge on the appeals court, to say, no, you're not allowed to do that. And in fact, part of the reasoning behind this guy, I'm not a lawyer, but I understand why Judge Myung Yeon had ruled back in May. He said, look, you can't fire people at the Department of Ed, because that would mean that Congress has passed a law creating the Department of Ed. Congress has passed laws creating all these programs and then funded the programs. But if you fire the people who actually carry out those programs, then somehow you are rescinding the laws. I think that even a non-lawyer like me or you could actually see the flaw in that argument. After all, let me make the comparison. During his 4 years as president of the United States, Joe Biden had laws that said you will safeguard America's border. You will regulate immigration. Those are laws passed by Congress decades ago. Then Congress passed a law creating Customs and CBP, Customs and Border Enforcement. They also passed ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. And they said these are the folks who carry that out, and these are the laws you're supposed to enforce. What did Joe Biden do? He repurposed many of the people at CBP and at ICE, and he put them in charge of filling out the paperwork to allow illegal aliens to come into the United States, not legally, but to allowing them to come into the United States. Was that actually rescinding the laws passed by the Congress? I don't think so. It was Joe Biden acting as an executive. Now, the fact is, a bad executive But I'm not entirely sure whether I can blame Joe Biden for all this, because it's becoming clearer and clearer with all the information we're getting about the use of the auto pen, about the amount of authority delegation that Joe Biden did. Joe Biden was not running that White House for even 1 minute of the last 4 years preceding Donald Trump coming in January. So the judge was deciding that it would require such a large-scale dismissal of staff, and he rejected the White House argument that it was merely reorganizing the department. The judge warned that the layoffs would likely cripple the Department of Ed. Well, it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch. Trump had signed an executive order back in late March, which directed Education Secretary Linda McMahon to take all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the Department of Ed and return authority over education to the states and local communities. Now, I would imagine that even though the Congress created the Department of Education, it was one of Jimmy Carter's brilliant ideas, even though they did that, if you kept even a small token staff there, you'd still have a federal Department of Ed. And it might even be capable of doing what the Congress originally set it up to do. And that was to assist the states in some of the work that they were doing. McMahon applauded the Supreme Court order today and said she is on the way to fulfilling the mandate to restore excellence to American education. And the Supreme Court has confirmed it. The president has the authority to run the executive branch of government, no matter what the liberals have to say. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, these are kind of extraordinary times. After those terrible fires in California, the ones that erased an awful lot of some of the most expensive real estate in the Los Angeles area, including Pacific Palisades. What do we have now? We've got a lot of people down there who have not been able to begin building their new homes. And then you get the governor of California who declares that getting rid of illegal aliens, well, that's going to cripple the effort to rebuild. I'm not kidding. I'm not exaggerating what Gavin Newsom says. Newsom says that illegal aliens are the, quote, backbone of our economy and that California cannot rebuild without them. This is crazy because I know people in construction. My brother-in-law works in construction. 41% of construction workers in California are illegal aliens. But Gavin Newsom says, I don't see many people like me jumping at those jobs. Well, actually, the people I know who work construction consider their paychecks pretty healthy paychecks. Nobody's going to complain about getting more, but they go for those jobs because they pay very, very well. And if you do the math, if 41% are illegals, then the other 59% are either citizens or green card holders. And yet Gavin Newsom, governor of California and probably hopeful for president one day, although I don't think he has a prayer, he's saying, no. Non-illegal aliens, citizens and green card holders, they're not going after those construction jobs. So letting the illegal aliens have them are not taking any jobs away from Americans. I thought I'd get a point of view on that, and I knew I'd get a good one from Nick Shivers, one of the many supporters of this program with his real estate business, the Nick Shivers team. Hey, Nick, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Lars.
I want to get your unvarnished opinion on Governor Gavin Newsom declaring illegal aliens the backbone of the economy and the backbone of the construction business.
Okay. So I went and dug deep on this with Lars because the first thing that I looked at is the percentage of undocumented construction workers across the country. And it says about 14 to 20% are undocumented.
Yep.
Oh, let's look at year over year first quarter in LA County, because this is where it's all coming out of. Their permitting is down 57% year over year. Okay, so if it's down 57%, and we'll on the high end, we have 20% of undocumented workers being deported, which we already know that's not true because only 2,800 people have been deported from L.A. County. That's the L.A.'s documented cases of being deported, 2,800. The math doesn't add up, Lars. What it is is politicians speaking. But here's the real thing. The real thing is this. Less than 1% of all those properties that were burned down have applied for permits in L.A. County. Why?
I think I could tell you, but I want to hear your theory first.
Because all the red tape, the Coastal Commission, all the red tape, which Donald Trump has said he was going to get rid of, but a lot of these cities are pushing back because they want to spread fear. They want to tell everybody it's because of the ICE raids, which I think in June, Mr. Trump said, I will not have raids on hotels, restaurants, meatpacking, and construction. So in all reality, it's a lot of talk and a lot of fear, which I think it does have an effect because there is not one documented case across the country where a national home builder has had a construction site raided. Not one. I looked for the last hour. Not one documented case.
Okay, and that makes sense. Let me go back to one of the numbers you cited first. If you've got down, the number of permits is down by 57%. Some of that could be the economy. It probably isn't just mortgage rates because those have been the same, you know, since about the beginning. Well, about the time that Joe Biden pushed them from their historic low in the threes or the twos all the way up to the sevens. And now they've dropped back to the sixes. So the mortgage rates have been pretty much the same for the last several years. So why is permitting down when they have so much of that city that needs to be rebuilt? Do you know?
Yeah, it's the continued red tape that they want to talk about the fearmonger instead of the real solution. Because politicians like to say affordable housing. Okay, the only way you're going to get affordable housing is builders getting tax incentives to build something that they're going to lose money on. Because it's a for-profit business, not a non-profit, and you got to make money. So, it's just common sense. Bill Pulte, okay, FHFA, third largest company in the country for new construction. You don't think he has President Trump's ear? Why is it that Pulte and Trump keep pushing for lower rates? Because that is the two biggest hindrance. It's mortgage interest rates, because you got to borrow money to build properties. Yep. And the second thing is red tape, which Trump is also trying to cut through. That's in his bill, the big, beautiful bill that was just passed.
Well, and one of the things I noticed, Rick and Nick, and tell me if you think this is right. I watched a developer on a video who posted it. He's a successful real estate and builder type in L.A. And he ran through all the numbers, said this is what it's going to cost. The land costs this much, even vacant. Then the construction costs this much, and the government costs this much. When you get all done, I think he figured out you've got, in this case, very high-end homes. He said you've got a home that cost you $7 million to create that's only worth $6 million, which means when you walk into the bank, they're only going to loan you about $5 million on it, right? Now, those numbers are roughly right. So if you say, if I have to spend $7 million to make something that ends up being worth $6 million that I can only get a mortgage on for $5 million, I can't do that deal. Nobody can they?
No, I mean, and remember, Lars, we talked about this about six, seven months ago.
Yep.
Let's just say the house, like you talked, $7 million in L.A. County on average was 32% of the cost was associated with bureaucracy.
Which is $2 million, right?
A little over $2 million.
Yeah. So in other words, if you took out most of that government cost, you still have to look at the plans and all that, but you don't have to have all the extra fees on it. If you drop that price by $1.5 million, then you're building a house that only costs you $5.5 million to build instead of $7 million. And it'll be worth $6 million, and you can mortgage it 4 or 5, and you'll get the mortgage financing you need, and the deal goes through. Otherwise, government makes it a non-starter, and it's one of the only factors you can actually change.
It's the two factors. The reason it's down so much across the nation is interest rates and mortgage rates and bureaucracy. Those are the two biggest issues. We have, even in this high interest rate environment, roughly around 6.8%, we have week over week, month over month, year over year, more applications for mortgages. Why?
Unbelievable. Nick, I've got to break away, but that's Nick Shivers, one of the many great supporters of this program. His business is called the Nick Shivers Team. In a moment, try to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. With everything going on.
Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson.
But you know what? I've never seen a federal agent working a case do is pull a mask up so nobody knows who they are and go out and terrorize a civilian population.
That is a woman by the name of Joyce Vance. And Joyce is a contributor at MSDNC, you know, the television network on cable that is one of the biggest supporters of the Democrat National Committee. The fact is, she's crazy. She says, I've never seen when law enforcement had to pull a mask over their face. Well, actually, I've been a reporter for about 50 years. I've seen it plenty of times. And in fact, when I worked in TV news, there were more than a few occasions where law enforcement agencies would say, if you caught officer so-and-so on camera, we're going to ask that you not show his face to the population because he works undercover and it might just get him killed. And yet she's objecting to the fact that raids are being carried out by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, an agency solely dedicated to enforcing one set of rules. Now, they are a different law enforcement animal than almost any other law enforcement in America. I mean, the FBI goes after every kind of crime. Local police go after every kind of crime. Your local county sheriff goes after every kind of crime. And yet when it comes to ICE and CBP, they enforce one set of laws, the immigration laws of the United States. And yet she's saying there's no reason for these people to run around with a mask that conceals their identity. Well, number one, when they show up to do a raid, most of them are wearing raid jackets or flak jackets to protect them against being shot. That say police across the front. And you say, well, I can get a jacket that says police across the front. Well, then you'd be impersonating an officer and you'd be breaking the law as well. But I would ask you this as a reasonable question, no matter what you think of Donald Trump, no matter what you think of his recent enforcement of America's immigration laws, which, by the way, was a campaign promise. So it's not as though he campaigned for president and didn't say, when I become president, we will have the biggest mass deportation of illegal aliens in American history. And yet, Joyce Vance says there's no reason for ICE agents to conceal their identity, and as a result, it might actually justify illegal aliens shooting at ICE officers. Take a listen.
You know, the danger to law enforcement, quite frankly, is that when you're masked like that and people don't know who you are, someone might exercise their lawful right of self-defense to protect themselves, thinking they're being kidnapped.
Now, this is absolutely ridiculous, and yet it's a line of thinking that you're hearing from liberal news networks, the cartel media. You're hearing it from liberal politicians and people like Joyce Vance, who's a contributor. She's there to give her opinion. Now, she's saying, well, maybe it's justified to shoot because you don't know who they are. Oh, so when a group of men show up, heavily armed with masks, and they have police written all over the front and back of their protective gear, you have no idea who they are. Well, guess how this worked out last week? I told you about the raid on the pot farm in California. I mean, I guess Gavin Newsom's attitude about all this is, well, that weed ain't going to pick itself. We need illegal aliens. And he's the same Gavin Newsom who runs around telling people that illegal aliens are the backbone of America's economy, which is the purest kind of hogwash. It is so insulting to Americans. I hope that people hold that in your memory so that when Gavin Newsom inevitably runs for president of the United States, that we all remind him, oh, it's not citizens. Those are the ones who can vote. You think that illegals are the backbone of the economy. Well, this headline I saw over the weekend, though, a man died on Saturday. He had been injured during the ICE raid last week at the California pot farm. I think it's called Glass House. And the headline was, California farm worker dies after chaotic federal immigration raid. So if you just read the headline, and there are an awful lot of people who just read the headline, you might be led to believe, well, after all, you mean ICE went out and they raided a place and the result of their raid was that this man died? Let me tell you the rest of that. A cannabis farm worker who was critically injured during a chaotic immigration raid by federal authorities in Southern California has died, according to his family. I'm sorry for his family. I'm not sorry for him. He caused his own death. Not just by being an illegal alien in California and then working in that pot business. No, it's much more direct than that. His name is Jaime, I'm not sure how he pronounced it, Alanis Garcia. So what did he do? When the ICE officers showed up, it is called chaotic by the news media. Why? Because when the police show up, the illegal aliens run in every direction in some cases. Well, that's what makes it chaotic. I'm willing to bet that ICE was very, very organized, that they had this planned well in advance, that they anticipated what people would do, and they came in very, very organized. What did the illegal aliens do? Well, they're trying to get away, so they run. Is that what makes it chaotic? Well, that's not the fault of ICE, any more than when you see a regular police stop, and they're all over social media these days, and somebody decides to fight the officer either by running or by fighting back. You know what the eventual result is likely to be, that the person who's the suspect ends up in custody anyway. I often wonder why they run, because in almost every case, they're going to get caught. They're going to end up with their face on the pavement. They're going to end up with a pair of silver bracelets in back, and they're going to be in custody. But what did Jaime or Jaime Alanis Garcia do? He worked at the pot farm, so he climbed to the top of a 30-foot-tall greenhouse, which was being used to grow marijuana, not exactly an essential crop as far as I'm concerned. And then up on top of this greenhouse, three stories off the ground, he fell off the greenhouse, and he broke his neck. Now, he stayed alive for a while. They managed to get him to the ambulance. Medical help was given to him by ICE and by some of his coworkers. He broke his neck and his skull in the fall. I think that's terrible. I wish it hadn't happened. Why did he fall? Because of ICE? Or did he fall because instead of doing what anybody who's a law-abiding person, meaning not an illegal alien, a law-abiding person would have said, if the police are here and I'm not guilty, I'm going to simply put my hands behind me, I'll be taken into custody, and my innocence will be shown, because America presumes innocence. And in fact, we have to let an awful lot of real criminals go to make sure that our system is overly fair to anybody accused of a crime. What did he do instead? He did something abundantly foolish. He ran from law enforcement, ICE in this case, climbed to the top of a tall building, and then fell. I don't think he jumped on purpose. He fell. Although he was not being pursued by law enforcement, is what Homeland Security says, this individual climbed up the roof of a greenhouse and then fell 30 feet. Now, whose fault is that? And the mainstream media is going to play this at, look, ICE caused this man's death. Because why? Because he wasn't even being pursued, but he decided to climb to the top of a three-story building and then proceeded to fall off, and that's the fault of ICE? That is what the mainstream media is trying to convince you of. And the liberals are telling you that, well, maybe they think they're being kidnapped and maybe it'll be justified for them to fight back for fear of their lives. That's what Joyce Vance was saying as well. It's crazy, but that's the line they're taking right now. And Gavin Newsom, he says that illegal aliens are the backbone of the economy. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I've never made my living at public radio, or as we now call it, state-controlled radio and TV. I've always made my living in the private sector, and there have been times that I've actually, years ago, decades ago, helped do some fundraisers for public broadcasting, which I thought better of later. Alan Mendenhall, though, is a guy who actually knows how to go into the lion's den. Alan is the senior advisor for Capital Markets Initiative at Heritage and recently retired from Alabama's public television. Alan, welcome to the program. And I have to admire a guy who says, look, I went on the board of Alabama Public TV to make sure that they were being financially responsible and not running programming that didn't align with the values of people in the state of Alabama where that public TV was. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
I mean, that's admirable that you would say, you know, I would imagine your values probably don't align with what most of us think of public television, but you did it anyway. And now you've left. Because the federal government is going to cut its funding for public TV and radio, a move that I actually approve of.
Yeah, so there's a little history here. A little over a decade ago, there was some ideological capture, probably no surprise, at the Alabama Public Television station. And a new board chair came in who was conservative, and he ensured that sort of we cleaned house. And I came on the board shortly after that. I came on in 2019, but I'm on the foundation board, which oversees all the finances, whereas the rest of the board is appointed by the governor per congressional district. And when I came on the board, my thing is, look, I don't think this entity should even exist, but given that it does and it's not going anywhere, at least I can do some good on this board by ensuring that programming aligns with the values of the people of Alabama, a very conservative state, and that the organization is being fiscally responsible. If it's going to get taxpayer money, I want to make sure it's not spending it on inappropriate stuff. So those were my motivations in joining when I joined. But what happened is the station, or Alabama Public Television, has gone out and publicly opposed the rescissions package, President Trump's rescissions package. And I can't, in good faith, serve as a fiduciary for this organization if it is taking this position that I disagree with, that I think is wrong. I support President Trump's rescission package. And since our values don't align, I can't, in good faith, say I can fulfill my duty of loyalty or my duty of care to this organization. So as a matter of conscience, as a legal and ethical matter, I had to resign.
Yeah, and I don't blame you for doing it. Alan, over the years, I've known people who work for public broadcasting, and they'll tell me two lines of stories. One is, I'll say, oh, you're taxpayer-funded. And they'll say, no. We get the tiniest little percentage of money from the federal government. It's barely a smidgen. And then you'll say, oh, so you wouldn't mind losing it. We can cut that off. Oh, no. If you cut that off, it'll wipe us out. We'll be flat broke. And I say, no, which one is it? It's a tiny smidgen of money and doesn't really matter, or it's your life and it's your the lifeblood of your organization. They'll tell you both those stories. Is there any reason not to defund them and say to public radio and public television, fund yourself like everybody else does, and don't force the taxpayers to finance television and radio that they don't agree with?
Yeah, if the programming were so great all the time, you wouldn't really need public funding. And let's face it, I mean, the media landscape is so different today from what it was when we first got these public broadcasting and national public radio. Now we have Twitter, we've got Facebook, we've got social media, we've got I don't know how many radio stations out there. We've got satellite radio. It seems almost anachronistic to be trying to subsidize these things by federal dollars. And what's so funny about it, you're exactly right on those fund drives. When I listen to our local public radio fund drives, I hear all the time, you know, we don't really defend on federal dollars, et cetera, et cetera. But now I don't know what the situation is for those local NPR stations in Alabama, but I can say Alabama Public Television's position is that they're going to lose $3 million annually if this recession's package is approved by the Senate. And that would be about, according to the executive director of Alabama Public Television, that would be about 13% of their budget. So it's like, which one is it? It's convenient to fundraise off the first message because in Alabama, everybody hates the federal government just about. And if they think they're just supporting the local stations, great. But now when it's time, when the rescissions package is on the table, now the narrative has flipped completely. So it's a very good point that you bring up.
Well, I'm just wondering if you were going to lose 13% of your budget, I'd say easy, cut six and raise six. And if you actually have public support for what you do, you shouldn't have any problem raising at least six. Maybe you can raise all 13, replace the money with local money, and no more federal strings. What's not to like about that?
Well, I think that's a great point. My friend Adam Thompson, who's the state director for Americans for Prosperity, the Alabama chapter, pointed out to me that, you know, it's $18.9 million that the Alabama Public Television gets out of the Education Trust Fund. That's a ton of money out of our state budget. I mean, Alabama doesn't have a lot of largesse like some other states have. So for APT to get that much money out of the trust fund budget is astounding. And by the way, that trust fund typically is reserved for schools, for things that are going to public schools or public universities. So it's a little unusual for something like Alabama Public Television to be getting that much money out of that.
Well, is it justifiable from this standpoint? Does APT actually deliver to the kids something that would make the $18 million worth it?
Well, and that's a really good point. Are there programming that's being used in schools? Now, I will say, I think, I like Masterpiece TV. I think there's some things that are on Alabama Public Television that are good, but they could be broadcast by other stations. It doesn't have to be, if they're really popular, some other local network could pick it up and use it. There's no reason why that couldn't be the case. So, although I don't find all of Alabama Public Television to be objectionable, some of the content I think is actually pretty good. But that doesn't mean that there aren't better forms of delivering the same material.
Yeah, they're just not as, I guess, lucrative for some of the people involved in it. I mean, at the national level, it always bothered me that you had Sesame Street with all these characters. And who owned the characters? Oh, the people who created them. So Sesame Street didn't actually benefit from them? No, there were a lot of people who made a lot of money, by getting them on public television, having every kid in America, I wasn't one of the kids, but having many kids in America introduced to Sesame Street and all this, along with some of the political messaging that Sesame Street does as well. And then a bunch of private sector people made money. And the public TV folks, they said, oh, we have to have the taxpayers pay for this. Well, I don't believe in taxpayer funding of media. I think it runs directly counter to the First Amendment. It's forced speech. I have to give my money to somebody to make programming that, for the most part, not APT, but about an NPR and PBS that I don't agree with. To me, that's telling my government telling me you have to fund speech that runs counter to your values.
That's exactly right. And NPR has gotten particularly egregious. I have commuted. Now I'm at the Heritage Foundation, so I come up to D.C. part of the month and still live in Alabama the other part of the month. But for 10 years, actually more than that, for about 13, 14 years, I was commuting from Auburn, Alabama to Montgomery, Alabama, or Auburn, Alabama to Troy, Alabama, So it was either an hour one way, an hour back, or an hour and a half one way.
And you're listening to public radio the whole way, and it doesn't match your values. Alan, thank you very much. Back in a moment. I'm going to get you your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson. Summer is the time.
What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got to give you just the front end of this, but the Washington Post has rolled out a story today, and I want to tell you what they're saying. You remember the floods in Texas? You remember the Camp Mystic was the Christian youth camp that was all girls that was so heavily hit. So many of the young girls, out of about 700 of them, there were about 23 from that camp who died because of the flooding. And the first the liberals after the flooding had happened, after the deaths had happened, said, this is because DOGE cut the staffing at the National Weather Service. Well, actually, the cuts take place on October 1st, and I pointed that out the next day. But what do we know now? The Washington Post is now reporting the executive director of that camp, a guy by the name of Dick Eastland. He had been running the camp since the 1980s. He got a warning on his phone from the National Weather Service at 1:14 a.m. Fix that number in your mind. So you get this warning on your phone. A severe flood warning for the area you're in at 1:14 a.m. When did he decide to begin the evacuation of the girls from that camp? 2:30 a.m., an hour and 16 minutes later, is when they began the evacuation. Now, I got to tell you something. There's a problem there, and it's not the National Weather Service. And that is coming not from a conservative publication, but from Jeff Bezos, Washington Post. Let me go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
I want to address the labor shortage that they try and say we need these illegal invaders to do our work.
Gavin Newsom. Yeah.
Yes, Gruesome Newsom, as I call him. The situation started in the Carter administration when I was 47 years ago, when I was 11 years old, Lars. My foster brothers used to go work at truck stops and work with landscapes and everything else in Fontana, California, where I grew up at.
Yep.
And it was even at the steel mill, they'd have you do light work during the summertime. You worked 40 hours, but you had two-thirds of the wages of minimum wage. And the point is this, over the last 47 years, starting in 1980, the last 45 years, they basically killed off the renewal of kids. They've not been best in school now, where they could go and work as a truck stop, 11 years old, 12 years old, dishwasher, and everything else, landscaping. I learned all these things, and I learned how to be fiscally responsible. Some of my foster brothers benefited from it, because by the time they were 18, they were buying homes. Because they developed a work ethic, they wasn't great at school, but they contributed to the American dream, Lars. And
well,
the point that I'm making is that by them wanting to just not get rid of the Carter Law and bring back early teenagers to start well the work ethic so we can get them in the trades, they learn to be on time, learn to weather storms unless you're really sick. They want to use the illegal aliens as an excuse so that way they can justify keeping them. And they're getting treated better than fully legalized or naturalized citizens that works and proved the bootstraps on them, sir.
I can't believe that Newsom is thinking of running for president, because to add insult to injury, not only does Newsom declare that illegals are the backbone of being able to rebuild California after those fires, which I think is false. He also admits 41% of the construction workers are illegal aliens. The other 59%, almost two-thirds, are either citizens or legal residents of the United States. So you got the problem there. A majority of the workers are American citizens or legal resident aliens, green card holders in America. But then he compounds that by saying there aren't a lot of people like me applying for those construction jobs. Ron, everybody I know who works in construction, they're either pushing close to six figures or they're in the high five figures. They're making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year. Now, Ron, do you think there are any Americans out there who would like to make $70,000 or $80,000 a year? I know plenty of them. And so for Gavin Newsom to declare, oh, these jobs are beneath us, we must have our slaves, our indentured servants, come in and do them for us. You know, I can't believe the guy is actually thinking of running for president, because his attitude is Americans won't go out and do hard work in construction sites, even though he has to admit 60% of the people doing the work right now are Americans.
But Lars, you hit the nail right on the head on that. And the facts, I'm going to back up what they're saying, and I've seen it with some of the mentor kids up and down the Willamette Valley on the coast and throughout Oregon and California, is that these businesses, if you go through even using the forest for the business and maybe clean up the forest, they're using contracted labor, maybe a legal owner that's naturalized, but they're using legal immigrants. They are doing segregational hiring, whether it's at a restaurant, like various restaurants I know throughout the Willamette Valley, because instead of hiring by merit, they are backdooring, the Democrat Party of West Coast is backdooring subjugation against European Americans, blacks, yep, and others that once achieved American dream. And they don't want them to mention that.
And by the way, Ron, I've heard from more than one father and at least a few mothers who've said, my kids are trying to get jobs, and they show up and they apply and they're told, I'm sorry, you don't speak Spanish. And as a result, your kid can't have the job because your kid does not speak Spanish. So it's that kind of segregation, saying can you imagine the outrage of liberals if you said, if you can't speak very good English, you can't have this job? Who would that work against? Illegal aliens. Now we've got illegal aliens in those jobs, and they're saying, I'm sorry, you can't work for us unless you can communicate with our illegal aliens. It's that crazy. This segment brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists.
The Lars Larson Show.